my friend Mark Adams says, Mr. Science, let's begin. He always begins with let's begin. So tonight I want to talk about a few odds and ends, just to get started. Then talk about the readings for a few minutes. I want to open it up to try to get you to talk a little bit tonight. I might need help from the film, which I'm going to show you tonight, at least to get started. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. So, a few odds and ends. Chocolate consumption, I sent you that. I actually think that anybody who's been to Sweden knows that what really does it for them is salmon. Because I remember when I got off the plane in Stockholm 20 years ago, there for the first time, the professor who picked me up took me to his nice house on a little body of water, and we had. First course was salmon. The second course was another form of salmon. And then there was another form of salmon. And then the salmon ice cream. No, I'm making that up. No, there really were at least three different forms of salmon in that little meal that he prepared. And then, of course, for breakfast, you have some really nice bread with salmon that you squeeze out of a tube, salmon paste. So I think the real next article for this guy is salmon. I probably said nothing about that. Somewhat more seriously, the President's Commission on Bioethics, or the President's Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues, to use its full proper name, published a report called Privacy and Progress about whole genome sequencing, not exactly neuroethics, however, relevance to neuroethics, obviously. And I just want to point out to you, I don't know if any of you got to look at the executive summary. Probably worth zipping through it, but the first and the principal example in the executive summary of privacy concerns and whole genome sequencing is as follows. I'm going to read you the relevant paragraph. In many states, someone could legally pick up a discarded coffee cup and send a saliva sample to a commercial sequencing entity in an attempt to discover an individual's predisposition to neurodegenerative disease. So don't leave your cups around here. You never know who I'm really working for. The information might then be misused, for example, by a contentious spouse as evidence of unfitness to parent in a custody case. Or the information might be publicized by a malicious stranger or acquaintance without the individual's knowledge or consent in a social networking space. And as I might have said to you before, I predicted a few years ago that some undergrad, maybe a Penn undergrad, would put their whole genome up on their Facebook page. And that's only a matter of time. It gets less funny as I say that. First time people thought it was very funny. Now it gets more and more, I think, real. Maybe it's already happened. I don't even know. In a social networking space, which could adversely affect that individual's chance of finding a spouse, achieving standing in a community, or pursuing a desired career path. So this is not as far out as it seems. If you can pick up some saliva and someday have enough information from that bit of saliva to sequence, and then, of course, the trick is you have to have all of the corresponding, basically, epidemiologic data, right, to do these fancy convergent correlations. Who the heck knows? There was an interesting WikiLeaks about 8 or 10 months ago when they sent out all that data that they'd gotten. I think it was from State Department files. And there's no reason for you to have noticed this, but one of the WikiLeaks memos was a State Department document that, among other things, advised Foreign Service officers attempt to collect, I guess, I'm not sure if they said coffee cups or whatever, from foreign citizens. The idea being that maybe you could collect their genetic data of foreign officials and, you know, use it in some compromising way. Now, they walked back on that really fast, but it does raise interesting security questions. And I'm going to take you back to illustrate this to the Second World War, when the U.S. government paid at least two psychologists, experts in personality theory, to do a personality profile of Adolf Hitler. And that notion that you could do these personality profiles and try to understand the kinds of decisions that these people would make has gone on ever since then. And there was the famous attempt to do a profile of Saddam Hussein, for example. Now, the data they're working with is obviously what? You know, long-distance psychoanalysis, the clinical experience, I guess, of the psychologists who tried to do that, basically gut feelings about how somebody is likely to behave based on the way they behaved before in foreign affairs and the decisions they've made. Henry Murray, who I think I've mentioned his name before at Harvard, was one of them, and he was the chief psychologist for the OSS during the war. And he roughly predicted the circumstances under which Hitler would commit suicide. So he was more, seems to have been, as I recall, more or less accurate. But you know, if you're going to invest money in this kind of long distance diagnosis, and there's a guy at UW, by the way, who has made a big name doing this kind of thing. Then why the heck not invest in some genomics, and maybe someday you'll learn something, you know, from some important decision maker's genome. I don't know if I don't think that's very imminent, but it's worth thinking about. And in providing my own segue, the Defense Science Board, which is one of the advisory boards to the DoD, has just published a new report, which is relevant to this, called Predicting Violent Behavior. And obviously, there's a lot of reason for the Defense Department to be interested in how you can predict violent behavior. And I'll come back to this when we get to the mind war stuff more directly, but predicting violent behavior not only for an individual, but for a group. Could you actually predict the circumstances under which a particular ethnic group would be prone to political violence? That's something that obviously would be very valuable if you could actually, you know, make those predictions and try to figure out what they would be like, that ethnic group or subgroup within a community or within a country would be doing under certain circumstances. What would be the triggers? That seems really far out from biology, but this Defense Science Board report considered the testimony of experts about biomarkers. And again, you're going to see a little bit of reference to this in Mind Wars. The general idea is that there might be some biomarkers that someday would help us to understand the circumstances under which people with certain racial, ethnic, genetic backgrounds could be more prone to violence. That sounds really crazy, but it is what many people think will someday be technically possible. And there is a certain amount of money being spent on it, and there's some few people who are working on it. They have, however, the Defense Science Board did not reach the conclusion that such predictions are plausible now. I'll read to you what they said that we can do predictions based on kind of traditional data about national politics and, you know, what a certain ethnic group has done before under certain circumstances. But they don't think that biomarkers are necessarily going to help us in the near term to predict violent behavior abroad. But this is their recommendation. I'll just read it to you. Initiate a biomarker-based measurement program to add hard data, hard in quotes, to the stress resiliency database. So the stress resiliency database is information about how, in the past, different groups in different countries have responded to social and political stressors. Political changes, the collapse of an economy, we need to be very aware of this right now in a place like Iran, the civil war in Syria, and so forth. First, with physiological measures, for which science is well documented. So what are physiological measures of reaction to stress? I don't know if you remember this, noticed this, because many of you probably weren't old enough to remember much, but when we started the war in Iraq, I mean the second one, there was a run on the pharmacies for antidepressants. Zoloft was flying out of the drugstores in Baghdad. So clearly people do experience, you know, probably physiologically measurable stress when they know that they're going to be bombed. And it's just a question of how you can figure out how to measure that from a distance, besides watching to see how many prescriptions for Zoloft are written by Baghdadi physicians in a certain week. So physiological, followed by neurological and genetic measures, if and when, or I should say if or when, it's F slash when in the text, I'm not sure what that means. What does slash mean? Is that and or? We need a logician here. If slash when the International Scientific Foundation matures. So these people are looking, 10, 20, 30 years into the future, and that's their job. What they're supposed to do is get the defense planners thinking about these long-range possibilities, including even genetic or neurological measures of reactions to stressors in a large community. Now, if anybody in this room can explain to me how that would actually work, that would be terrific. And I'm not sure anybody really knows how it would actually work, how you would actually do that. But the point is that people are thinking about this. The Defense Science Board is an authoritative body. But we'll come back. One of the problems with this, for me, is that every day there's something in the neuroscience literature that's relevant to this course, and in particular to the national security end. And so I'm kind of holding back a little bit on some of the details of these things until we get to the last couple of weeks of the course. Can anybody explain to me how you're going to do this? How you're going to do neurologic, physiologic, and genetic measures of proneness to violence or stress resiliency with, the Shiites as against the Sunnis? I mean, that's the kind of thing they're really interested in.
Statistics.
Stat, yeah. It's sort of like the weather, right? You feed in a whole bunch of variables and into an algorithm of some kind, and something comes out. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's my answer to everything is just get the algorithm. Still, I'd like to know how you actually do that, and what garbage in, garbage out, and so forth, right? What data you actually collect. So that was very helpful. Thank you. Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Do entities like the Defense Science Board have an independent review of what it means for the science to mature? Because that's really the concern,
right?
If they simply are taking the claims of scientists or worse, secondhand reports.
Right. So the people who sit in the advisory, it's a good question. The people who sit in the advisory boards are not, employees of the Defense Department. They're scientists, engineers, academics, physicians. So they are independent in that sense. It's probably, and they also have people testify who are independent, right? As well as people who are in the system. It's probably true that scientists, like anybody else who's in a certain field, is pretty enthusiastic about what they think is the cutting edge stuff that they happen to be working on in their lab. So you are probably, and I think we can document this historically, you are probably getting a certain level of enthusiasm for the possibilities of the science. And it is partly a matter for the board itself to be very realistic about what can be done, what can't be done. Now, when we get to mind wars, and I said I'm struggling not to talk about this stuff too much at this point, but we'll see a very interesting example of what we're talking about. That is to say, a failure for a long time to be self-critical about where the science can go. And the example is what one might roughly call parapsychology, or ESP. Anybody who saw, I'm kind of blowing my punchline here, but anybody who saw The Men Who Stare at Goats knows what I'm talking about. There was, in fact, a long-standing program in the Defense Department to try to exploit the possibilities of parapsychology or ESP, I guess you could call it mind reading, mind control, psychotronic weapons, it's sometimes called. Right? They actually spent money on these things. Why did they spend money? Because there were people at major places like J.B. Ryan at Duke who, you know, were distinguished people who believed that you might be able somehow to figure out how this can work when it works. You know, when it works. So the idea of, that some of you may know, the idea of remote viewing, you know what that is? The remote viewing is the notion that some people have the ability to see themselves, you know, to see a place as though they were in it, even though they've never been in it. Now, if you've ever been to a party where one of the entertainers is a mentalist, it's really amazing what they can do. And so one of the challenges, you know, that people like, remember the amazing Randy, who's still alive, the magician, always issues for claims like this is, bring the magicians in, not the scientists. Because it's amazing how much the magicians know and they can do themselves if you pay them enough. You know, that looks very much like what some of these people purport to be able to do. But that's a really, I mean, we'll come back to that. I think it is a provocative example of how, you know, the scientists do get enthusiastic, understandably, but how far ahead are they going? Yeah?
So, aside from the concern about the accuracy and power of the science and the maturity of the technology itself, even if we did have, you know, reliable science and powerful technology, how ethical would it be to, like, you know, what would we do with that information? Like, so if, for instance, we knew that a certain racial group was more prone, like statistically more likely, and we knew this with certainty to react violently to the situation, what would we,
do with
based
that?
Upon that? And this kind of takes me back to, like, the Conley article last week, which talked about, you know, how they mentioned we're discussing whether it's fair or not to detain someone based upon whether they have a predisposition to have a violent personality or not.
Yeah. I mean, great question. The truth is I don't know what you would do with it, but we can speculate together, right? So let's imagine that that the odds were, you know, great that a certain ethnic group in a certain country is going to take to the streets, right? So that at least would give you some time to do some planning and to think about how you would do an intervention, like Syria, for example, right? Where I think there's this big debate right now about whether the administration has handled that properly or not. It might be that you could do an intervention that would diffuse tensions. Like, for example, the Iranian currency is dropping like a rock now. Maybe you would want to let the central bank release a whole bunch of new funds, right, to prevent a violent attempt to overthrow a regime that is not going to want to be overthrown. You can imagine that there are certain kind of interventions or certain kind of planning that you could do if you knew something was likely to happen. But you know, in the real world, plans Afghan and Glay, that's the Afghan and Glay, Middle English, I think, is it? So you know, who knows what could happen? But look, the thing is that your tax dollars are going to people in the national security world who don't like surprises. And their job is to prevent us and to prevent the system from being surprised. So anything that can be done, that the science can possibly provide to prevent surprise so that we can plan or intervene or both, is something that, you know, their obligation is to try to provide that to the people who actually have to make the decisions. But I think, obviously, yeah, it's a really good question. What do we do with that information? The people who really got into this, and this is a little bit far field, but what the heck, the people who really started to worry about planning for extreme circumstances, it's a pretty recent effort, right, where people at the Rand Corporation after the Second World War. And so if you ever want to really not sleep well some night, you can read a book that's about 1,000 pages called On Thermonuclear War by Herman Kahn. You ever hear of Herman Kahn? So Herman Kahn was the first important, I guess you'd say, theorist, strategist of the nuclear era. And on Thermonuclear War, coldly, in a dispassionate way, estimates how many tens of millions of people would be killed under certain circumstances, a nuclear war, how much throw weight was the term you have to have in a weapon. And, you know, they would try to plan. Now, I guess what I want to say at this point is, gee, if you're going to plan for, you know, a nuclear war, if you think you can do that, then why not try to plan for violence in a certain country? You know? If anybody's... there are two great films, of course, as you know, you have to watch movies to understand what I'm talking about. One is called Dr. Strangelove, and the other, Failsafe. And in both cases, you have a person who's based on either Herman Kahn or his most famous protege, Henry Kissinger, who is, you know, in a very objective way, calculating the effects of all-out nuclear exchange. So, if you were to trace this kind of extreme event planning in the defense, in the security establishment, you'd probably start with the nuclear weapons guys, and then you'd find yourself now in this neuroscience era where we're trying to do the same thing, essentially, with different data. And again, I'm sure there were people who were trying to figure out what the odds were that the Kremlin would actually use a bomb and so forth, under what circumstances. But in the missile crisis, it just came down to Kennedy's intuition and a decision to ignore one telegram and not ignore another one, or telex, whatever it was. Anything else on any of this? Yeah.
It's just from a statistics standpoint, I think you have to think that people are already using that type of data on people groups, because people groups, you have so much information on.
Yeah.
There's so many observations that you can get and so much history behind it that they already have to be using that information. I think it's more individuals within people groups.
Yeah.
Because once you don't have historical information on a person, usually that's where your variability gets so big you can't predict what's happening. But within a people group, absolutely you can predict what's going to happen.
Yeah, without necessarily having fancy genetics.
Right.
Yeah, you may be right. I'm sure, no question, but that you're right that there are many people in this defense establishment who have a big picture notion of the history of various groups and what is likely to trigger some kind of reaction to different kinds of events. I don't know that they, would have predicted those Danish cartoons of the Prophet. Right? I mean, so you do learn as you go along. But I will just say to you, I'm going to leave it here, and when we get to Mind Wars, you'll see there's I provide a little paragraph about one fellow who definitely thinks you can do large human groups, and that you can do it using genetics. Somebody's going to bet right on that.
So Craig Venter already has an entire sequence.
Yeah.
On the internet. How is this any different than, say, Target, which knows all my buying habits and can predict what I'm going to buy next, or like what's going on in my household, basically?
The principles are the same, right? It's just get enough data, and then you can make a prediction within a certain confidence interval, as the statisticians would say. Yeah. And it's like the weather, right? So today, they were right. It did rain in Philadelphia. Yeah. I mean, in principle, it's sort of the same. But again, it's how do you get what data are they talking about? Yes, right? It's what's the basic data that you're putting into the system. That's what I find puzzling. Am I not connecting to...
It totally is. I'm just wondering how much of this is like a visceral gut reaction, because somehow we feel it's like more personal because it's like my genetic code as a base.
I see. Yeah, sorry. So there's the privacy issues coming up. And it has to do with the mystification, perhaps, of the genome, right? When I started teaching ethics and genetics, I would routinely say, so this is late 80s, right? So we know that someday we're going to learn for sure that there are 100,000 genes in the human genome. It turns out to be 21,000, maybe a little bit more than that. We've learned that the genome is not the blueprint that it was sold as in the 90s. You know, let's face it, in order to get support from the public and from Congress for the Human Genome Project. As I heard one top scientist say, well, first it was genomics, now it's proteomics, right, because there's so many proteins now. Hundreds of thousands, we don't even know. Part of this is probably, and I think you're alluding to this, the mystification of the genome as something really private. Maybe it isn't. On the other hand, what about the brain? Coming back to neuroethics. You know, maybe the brain really is something that is uniquely private. Maybe there's a qualitative difference between genomics and neuromics. We don't know yet. And partly it's the philosophical issues that you and I have been talking about. Is it essentialism, right, to think that? So why don't we do these two readings, and then we'll see where we are, because I think we'll come back to some of this. So just so you know a little background, Wolpe was at Penn. He's now at Emory. Dan Langleben is still a neuroscientist at Penn. So there's always, you know, Penn people doing mind reading, which is why you should be nervous walking around here. So what is mind reading? I always find the idea of mind reading a little puzzling. The truth is, we read minds all the time. And I'm getting signals from you. Some of them are not conscious signals. You're getting them some from me. We're really good at that. We've evolved that way. That's how we're able ever to mate, you know, without violence, is through some kind of mind reading, you know. What's your sign? You know, presumably I wouldn't even ask you what your sign is at the bar until I got a good vibe of some kind, unless I'm really clumsy and idiot, which I probably am. But nonetheless, we don't really know what this means. I think, as I said probably to you before, this whole notion of mind reading is probably going to, the definition of it is probably going to change if and when we're ever able to do it or approximate it. I mean, we do use words that we don't really know what they mean, for, you know, like the gene, for example. That word was, you know, that's an ancient Greek word, but it's quite ramified by what's happened in science in the last 100 years. But maybe this is what it means. It means these correlates are going to get to a certain critical point, and then the question is whether you can actually do lie detection using these kinds of technologies. Remarkably few new principles have been suggested about how to handle information like this and respect privacy. So one group has urged that we have a concept of cognitive liberty, which is basically the idea that my thoughts should only be my thoughts unless I grant you access to them. Of course, when you think about that for a moment, you realize that you have access to my thoughts often without my wanting you to have access to my thoughts, even though you may not be fully aware of it. It's just the way evolution works, or the way our ability to interact with each other as sympathetic minds has evolved. So so-called lie detector, it's amazing how we use words or expressions and then assume that we know what they mean. A lie detector is a good example of that. It's not a lie detector. It doesn't detect lies. But it does detect changes in physiology. I was once told by a guy who used to be in naval intelligence that the reason that so-called lie detection is so popular for forensic purposes is that it's a great opportunity for retired FBI guys to have part-time employment, walking into people's offices with lie detectors, or so-called lie detectors. I don't know if that's true or not, but it has a kind of sociological truthiness about it. Lie detection for the, I think we don't even have, do we have a lawyer in the room tonight? Besides Ken, you don't count. like a law student. As far as I know, according to Hank Greeley at Stanford in the law school, there is no jurisdiction in the country that actually admits so-called lie detector evidence in court. With the exception, he says, of New Mexico. Don't ask me why. There's some jurisdiction in New Mexico that has admitted it. But lie detectors are basically used by police forces to intimidate potential witnesses, or potential, you know, people of interest. That's their usefulness. Once they're, you know, in the hands of a competent operator, I heard a guy who was a trainer, an interrogation trainer, for the FBI say last year that he regards them as about 70% accurate. Now 70%, again, when you get into the policy framework, is not terrific, right? So that's not so great. But 70%, well, you know, you and I would probably do almost as well, just randomly guessing about whether somebody's lying or not. So the guilty knowledge test is a little bit better. It looks for what are essentially forced choices. The guilty knowledge test has been combined with infrared photography, functional MRI. People have more confidence in the guilty knowledge test than in these control question tests that are used with so-called lie detectors. And then there's there's quite a bit of information, and I write about it in Mind Wars, so we'll come back to it, about this idea of a brain fingerprinter. Now we're in a totally oxymoronic universe. I can't even conjure an image of what a brain fingerprinter would be. I mean, you know, if you were to make a cartoon, what would that look like, a brain fingerprinter? In any case, it's obviously a cool term, right, if you believe it works, because fingerprinting is unique. I guess you could take somebody's brain out and, you know, put it in some ink and then slap it on the paper. I don't know. But I don't even think that the fissures are unique in the brain particularly, so I'm not sure that works. Anyway, there was a guy named Lawrence Farwell. It was a company called No Lie MRI. I think Martha mentioned it. And apparently he's managed to convince some people in authority that they should try it. So clearly, if you could figure out what lie detection is, in the first place, you could actually potentially make a whole lot of money with such a device. Is it on this slide? The next slide. Ah, okay. So I'll come to that. Okay. So the similar limitations to lie detectors and neurotechnologies, problems with false negatives and false positives, and then if you're a low prevaricator, which means that you don't lie too much. It's pretty hard to pick up when you are lying, which I think is sort of interesting. So I guess, you know, there aren't too many low prevaricators who have lives of crime. So maybe that's not a big problem in criminal justice, I don't know. I think that nobody has really written enough in the context of neuroethics about the question that I have in italics here. Maybe I'm wrong about this, like everything else. What is a lie? What is it to tell a lie? So I'll give you a very straightforward response that's used by a semiotician. A semiotician is a symbol theorist. I used to work in symbol theory. This is a guy named Umberto Eco, who was very hot in the sort of 70s and 80s. He wrote a very successful novel called The Name of the Rose. I think it was around the early 80s. It was sort of the Da Vinci Code of its day, you know, because there were lots of puzzles in it and stuff. But before that, he wrote a serious textbook about symbol theory. He's an Italian linguist and philosopher. Still around, I think. So Eco defines a sign as anything that can be used to tell a lie. Which is provocative, right? So, you know, who did it? That's a sign. This is kind of a sign. Now, he didn't do it, but I can use it to point, you know, to indicate him. And in fact, this is exactly my index finger that is doing the indicating. And, you know, I'm lying. It's a sign. Or I could give a proper name instead. It's a sign. So that's one way of understanding what a lie is. But, yeah.
A couple slides earlier.
Yeah.
And no, you don't have to go.
Okay.
We talked about what is a lie, but, you know, it almost was described as an attempt at deception. So it's not
an attempt at deception.
Something wrong. It's just trying to deceive.
Excellent. Do you know when do we always know when we're attempting to deceive? Let me give you an example. I just like to give an example because I love to tell this story. So about 3 years ago, I was at a meeting in Glasgow, which, by the way, you really don't need to go to Glasgow, but, you know. Cut that out, please, of course here. I don't want the Glaswegians writing me nasty letters. Edinburgh is terrific. So I was at a meeting in Glasgow about some of this neuroscience stuff. And I raised the question when I was giving my standard talk. I should say it was sponsored by the Scottish Parliament, okay? This meeting. The Scots, it turns out, are extremely interested in science. And they actually believe in evidence-driven policy, which is rather unique for most governments. They're really, really into it. So they're interested in, now, you know, in neuroscience like everybody else. So I raised the question, what is it to tell a lie? And I said, for example, and I use this example in my classes, although at Penn, although I'm careful for obvious reasons. not to do what I did in Glasgow that day, which was point to somebody. Okay, so, or an established eye contact. You'll understand why. So I said, imagine, God, these stories are really convoluted, aren't they? So imagine you're 19 years old, 20 years old, you're out with that special someone. You know, it's the first time you've been with them, and you look at them over the wine and whatever else you've ingested, and you do what people that age have done for eons. You say, and I fixed on the eyes of a woman who's a little younger than me, just for the honest sake, but I said, you know what I said, right? I love you. Notice I didn't fix anybody here. Don't be accused of harassment. And I fixed on her eyes. And so the point being, of course, how do you, you know? Are we really sure? I mean, maybe that's the extreme case. The extreme case is something very abstract like love. Nonetheless, I do think we're not always sure of when we're prevaricating or not. If that's true, and I'm not talking about, you know, being somewhere and forgetting about it, that's different, right? But the accurate reports of our internal psychological states are a lot trickier than we normally consider them to be, I believe. But the punchline of that story was that somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you just told the senior science advisor to the Scottish Parliament that you loved her. Now, there is a further story, which is also great, because she was the official in charge of the conference, and so, of course, she had to close the conference, and so her last little, her closing remarks started as follows. I really enjoyed this conference because I learned so much about neuroscience, and also because it's the first time that any keynote speaker has looked at me and told me that he loved me. Really cute. So, anyway, did you want to pursue the question of do we know when we're prevaricating or not? I'm not so sure. I'm not even sure now that I know if I just prevaricated. you know, there's a reason Escher was so popular, and this does get a little weird and complicated. So, okay. That's all I really want to talk about on that slide. I told you the best stuff that I could tell you. Finally, there's this long list of ethical issues at the end. Premature adoption of science, same problem we were talking about before. Thermal imaging. So anybody ever gone to Beijing or Tokyo and you walk, remember that? How that, yeah. So you know what I'm talking about, right? They want to, because of SARS.
They measure your temperature,
yeah.
As soon as you're in the country.
Right, the infrared. So there's a very interesting thing in the new Beijing airport. There is a point at which is spectacular, by the way, put up for the Olympics. Have anybody been there? In this airport? So,
yeah.
You know, remember, I thought it was really interesting. The new Beijing airport, on the way in, of course, there's an infrared scan, which you can see there are women in uniform sitting at a podium, and you can turn back and you can see the people who have been scanned because they're looking for is elevated temperature. But the way the new Beijing airport is also, they also don't want to let you out of the country, right? So there's a point in the new Beijing airport where you're dumped out with beautiful escalators in a gorgeous hall on a long, like 30, 40 yard long, I think, corridor, which is open, or, you know, space, plaza. And then you walk past the people who were sitting behind these little laptops, and it's very, you know, well orchestrated architecturally. And okay, the problem is, according to public health people I've spoken to, these are incredibly unreliable measures. They're doing them really mostly for public relations purposes to convince the rest of the world that they're really serious about stopping an infection next time. There's thermal imaging. There are misapplications, as many would allege. The P300 is a misapplication. The privacy issues we've talked about. Incidental data comes up. By the way, it also comes up in the President's Commission's report on privacy genomics. And, of course, then there's a question of whether you can ever use this stuff reasonably for forensic purposes, which is probably mostly for intimidating witnesses or persons of interest. So,
You know, it would have been interesting if they took it further, because, you know, they were sort of using what might be on today's technology.
Yeah.
But one could imagine that you have a functional MRI or something of that nature where it's a camera somewhere else, so you don't even know that you're being scanned.
Sure.
You know, and it could be beyond defense, it could be in business negotiations or other sorts of things as well. So it would be interesting to sort of take it the next level of what the next technology could be, and that could easily be something that could be...
Well, it's probably not going to be thermal imaging.
Well, no, but something, but, you know, let's use MRI. So
yeah.
If you had an MRI camera that was, you know, really that little red thing over there, that you wouldn't know that you were even being scanned or watched.
Yeah, but it's not going to be MRI. I mean, people are trying to figure out what it could possibly be. MRI is not going to do it because the magnet, you know.
Sure.
But, it would have to be bigger than this building, and, you know, and as I mentioned last time, all the metal in your body would be sucked into the magnet, so you would know something funny's going on. What could it be? I mean, there are people who think maybe ultrasound.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. But this is all in the lab, right? It's all in the lab. But this is, you know, this gets us into the interesting security questions, which we'll come back to. So, just to make sure that you've recorded this problem that is talked about in the second reading, neurorealism, neuroessentialism, and neuropolicy, obviously there are different ways. There's neuro for everything, but these are three different kinds of limitations or ways of thinking of limitations of neuroscience. And I just put this question at the bottom because this is a very challenging problem in science policy that people at places like the AAAS, the National Academies, worry about constantly. How do you communicate complex science through the media to the public? It's amazing. I mean, some of you work with scientists. Ask them if they've had any experience with the media, with journalists. Scientists in general, in my experience, are not happy about talking to journalists. And because the way that it often goes is this. Hello, Professor so-and-so, I see that you, or they call them doctor, actually. I see that you just published a paper in the journal Science. What I want to know is, you know, I see it's about something about cancer, and the scientist says, yes, well, you know, and he or she goes into a 5 or 10 minute explanation of the study, and the journalist says, you know, doc, you know, my readers aren't scientists. Can you just kind of say it a little more, you know, a little more simply, a little more directly, what's the study about and why is it important? And the scientist, and I've heard this story from a number of people, this is the way they describe their experience with journalists. Okay, well, and then he does a 2 or 3 minute version of the 10 minute explanation, and then the journalist says, doc, you know, look, is this going to be a cure for cancer? And so, well, you know, if we learn this and that and the other thing, it could take us in the right direction. And, of course, the headline the next day is, Dr. So-and-so at local university has a cure for cancer. Now, that's the way many scientists feel about talking to journalists. That they, you know, even go further than dumbing it down. They sort of dumb it down and they prop it up at the same time. So this is a problem that people think about a lot. How do you communicate complex science to journalists? We saw it in the stem cell debate, which I've talked about at length in the last class I taught. It's very difficult to do this, and obviously neuroscience is as prone as any field right now, if not more, to the kind of public relations exaggeration that scientists worry about. Which takes us to the Phelps study. So I made it optional, but I hope some of you got to look at 4.5, the reading 4.5. What do you conclude? What would you conclude? So you know what the popular conception is of Elizabeth Phelps' study about amygdala activation, looking at faces of people that you think are not in the same ethnic group, right? She has found that there is increased amygdala activation, even though people won't admit
to any kind of prejudicial views. The combination of the neuroscience that she's done and the questionnaire, which is designed to elicit de facto racial or ethnic prejudice, seems to have, on her view, based on her data, very uncontroversial positive results. It looks like there really is amygdala activation for these subjects. But what do you make of that? What does she say about that? What does that tell us about
people's prejudices or?
Yeah.
I unfortunately didn't read the chapter, but I've heard this before. How do you relate that to just like the basic idea that I have seen more of like my ethnicity just by interacting with my parents, and for the first years of life, that's been encoded in me as this is
right.
close
this
safety.
Is the norm. And
also you associate safety, like your mother's voice is soothing to you. And yes, that's a very specific base, but
yeah.
your brain goes through multiple things to determine what the base is. And so
right.
I didn't know it's not something just to do with that, and then other bases, just their deviation from what you know is safety just creates this.
It's a good question. My guess is that she would say, well, that's fine. I mean, that is in fact what does happen.
But then do you call it, is that really then like racial bias, or is it then, like, does that go?
Probably control for that base.
I would imagine you could control for it. Anybody else want to respond to that? Yeah.
I would think, like, even if that's the underlying basis for the discrimination, it would still be seen as, like, proof of discrimination. Like, even if it wasn't malicious, it would still, like, highlight an implicit association or an implicit.
Yeah, you still see them as the other, as strange. You do. Go ahead.
I don't know how clearly I'm going to be able to articulate this, but I see this a lot.
You'll do better than me, I'm sure.
I see this a lot with cognitive neuroscience research that tries to get at, like, sociological questions, not just, like, racism, but also, like, you see it a lot with, like, morality research
yeah.
and, like, that kind of stuff, where, like, the fMRI doesn't care about these, like, categorical, philosophical categories that we've created. Like,
right.
it doesn't care about racism as we've defined it. And so, like, when
right.
she's finding increased amygdala activation, that's all.
That is what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't mean.
Which is sort of the answer to my question.
Right,
yeah.
exactly. And so, like, I mean, I feel like we as non-scientists are, like, pulled towards this tendency to, like, create a narrative around these results, when in reality, like, it just means that there's increased blood flow to the amygdala. Like,
right.
it.
What can you infer
fact
from
that?
We're
equating that with racism is is a function of us creating the category in and of itself, you know?
I think that's probably right. quite literally. Yeah.
On a bit of a tangent, but related to what Tina just said, kind of reminds me of an anecdote that I heard from Dr. Andrew Newberg. We both took a class with him on neuroimaging.
Yeah.
So he does a lot of work on, like, spirituality and the brain. And so he published the one study which kind of pinpointed a specific brain response to in religious people versus non-religious people.
Right.
He, like, had the objective claim that this part of the brain is associated with this.
Yeah.
And then the next day he got two phone calls. The Atheist Association called him up and said, thank you for proving that, you know,
it's all in the brain.
Yeah. And then he also got a call from the church, from some church, saying, thank you for proving that this whole religious thing is
right.
real.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he thanked both of them equally.
Right.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So that goes back to, like, neurorealism and what's objective, what's
yeah, and what is, that's right. Again, this happens in genetics too, right? The gay gene, right? So if there were a gay gene, which there isn't, if there were a gay gene or a straight gene, would that lift the burden of being gay or straight? Or would that reinforce the social burden of being gay or straight? That goes either way. Interestingly, if you get to the end of her piece, she notes that even somebody who does not have a highly activated amygdala because of a trauma responds to the social behavioral tests as having some level of ethnic or racial prejudice. So the amygdala is not the only organ that's responsible, whatever responsible means, that is the physiological substrate of these kinds of reactions to the other. It is only one. So amygdala activation is not decisive, obviously, for having these kinds of reactions to the other. Anybody else in any of this? So in other words, if you just down-regulated the amygdala, sadly, you would not eliminate racial prejudice. There seems to be a whole lot of systems involved, or at least more than the amygdala. Yeah?
I guess my main question is when, as we're starting to do this, is there any concept of, like a lot of us seem to assume, or at least our understanding is just kind of, you show some brain region associated with this, and then there's like direct connection where there's a lot of, there's like a, like consciousness or like choosing, like make decision things come out of more than just, like, is there any just a disconnect between the brain correlate being like, okay, this correlates with that. That doesn't mean that this brain's like activation causes that. That
exactly.
Could just be simply either an extra effect or that just goes along with it and that represents that in the brain, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's what it is in the world. I'm showing like, is that separation happening in like the literature or anything? In the news, that's never ever a distinction.
No, I think people are. I mean, that's I think partly what the authors are trying to get at in this list here on this slide. Perhaps the distinction isn't made often enough, but again, that's why the journalist question comes up, right? So it's in informal circumstances, it's much easier for people to understand, well, it is, the amygdala is the organ of racism. Because once you start entering into the counterexample territory, people turn the page and read sports. But I think, you know, a careful scientist will make these distinctions and will not try to reach ontological conclusions. But it's sort of hard not to. Particularly in informal conversations, right, outside of a science paper. And ultimately, isn't that what we want, right? We want to try to reach these sort of ontological conclusions about the real nature of the thing. It's hard to restrain oneself, it seems to me, from wanting to do that. And I want to know if it's basically the brain or not. But that question, that statement, you know, doesn't really make sense in the context of careful science.
Okay, anybody else in any of this? Pornography does change your brain, by the way, as was alleged by a presidential candidate recently.
And so does everything else, which William James taught us in 1890.
Every experience changes your brain. So can't give you any help there. Comments, questions, anything else? Let's take a 5-minute break, and then I'm going to introduce the film, and then we'll see what we can get out of that for after viewing it for a little while. Looks like it's going to work.
So I had a follow-up question on so you mentioned during the culture that you're not sure if there's anything like amongst the U.S. courts that permits using lie detection
technology. Yeah, it has to meet any science evidence has to meet
right.
The film that we're going to show, is that what kind of file?
I mean, source is completely dubious, but as Wikipedia, the brain fingerprint, for instance, not my favorite source too. But it seemed to reference like a couple of court cases that actually used the
right, but the apparently they were not decisive. In other words, they were technically not considered as evidence in the case, even though they were introduced in court.
Apparently, there was like a Harrington versus State case.
That's the one on the side.
Right. Which
that was a death penalty case, I think, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Supposedly, the evidence was not used, so it really wasn't technically admitted. But there was an Indian one that did admit evidence in the case of the Muslim.
Right,
exactly. So what people are worried about, is that it'll be premature.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
I have this small.
I'm sending you just to show you what we've got so far. That's bad job, so
talk about this when Mike comes, but yeah. So you're familiar with the debate at places like Gallaudet about cochlear implants and the cultural issues with the hearing impaired community. So that's what you're referring to, right? So basically, so this got to be an issue at Gallaudet, which, as you, I presume you know, is a university for the hearing impaired in Washington, District Columbia, and it's very old. It's like post Civil War. About, I guess, 20 years ago this started, the question whether it would be somehow leaving the community, the hearing impaired community, to have a cochlear implant. Or, you know, the argument is that signing itself is a culture, you know, is organic to a certain culture, a certain way of being with other people, and that the technology compromises this unique culture. I was actually asked, I think it was in 1985, to write a paper on ethics and cochlear implants. There weren't any papers in bioethics. And I had the foggiest idea what the issues were. So I passed it up, which was, in retrospect, one of many stupid career moves. This became a big issue, and I think it's, we'll hear what Mike has to say about it, but I think
the idea that, you know, this child had it, sort of, the decision was made for him by his parents. I was so interesting to me that even then, 7 or 8 years ago, a third of the kids in that class had cochlear implants. I'm sure it's more now, certainly in Japan. There is a certain uniqueness about what happens in a signing culture that I think is probably undeniable. And yet, you know, there's this practical issue of being able to function in a hearing world. But it has become a very divisive issue at some of these places. Yeah.
Just from personal example, we have a family friend who lives in the Domus. They had a child with Torres syndrome, which was like a genetic congenital disorder, and one of the things is that he was born deaf. So he was deaf until he was like 2 and a half. His mom's a doctor and helped decided that they wanted to do the cochlear implants. He was going to like a specialty deaf nursery school, I guess, where they were like teaching him sign language and like interacting obviously in sign.
Yeah.
And when the school found out that his parents were planning on getting him a cochlear implant, they terminated his enrollment.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, planning to get the surgery, having the surgery, recovering from the surgery, learning to live with it is like a year, 2 year, 3 year process. So now you have this like 3-4 year old kid.
Out of school.
Yeah, he's out of school and they can put him in regular school, but now he's in this weird place where he doesn't really belong in deaf school, but he can't really keep up in regular school either because just learning how to deal with the
hearing world.
His speech obviously was really delayed because he didn't hear for a while, and so you know the onset of speech is really delayed. Anyway, so interesting that they would kick out essentially someone just for planning on sort of changing their disability.
Yeah, it becomes almost a civil rights issue for that community. Who we get to decide who's part of the community. The scientists don't, the doctors don't, you know, the parents of this kid don't get to decide, and if you're in or you're out. So it's a very interesting sort of membrane, right, between that community and the rest of the world. I don't know how I taught before I had anecdotes. You know? So it's a good thing that for 35 years I've been able to collect them. So I'm going to tell you another one. My predecessor at the University of Virginia was a guy named John Fletcher, who had been the first ethicist at the NIH. And John grew up in Texas, and I should say, by the way, that John's sister was Louise Fletcher, who won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress in a great film.
One film.
Yeah, very good. Cuckoo's Nest, exactly. So John and his sister grew up with parents in Texas who both could not hear, and they became their interpreters to the rest of the world. And John would talk about the fact that it really was like being an anthropologist or a field linguist, you know, creating a connection between that community and the hearing community. And I think that's one of the things that actually got John interested in bioethics, because in what started to happen when people appreciated the possibilities of sort of recombinant DNA and modern genomics is that people also realized that you may be able to decide to have a kid who could not hear. That could be, this is a kind of issue that comes up if you ever take, I guess, a course in ethics and, you know, reproduction. What if you could select for a fetus that was hearing impaired? Would that be acceptable to bring a child like that into the world? And then sort of you go down the sort of this path, and then you raise questions about people who've raised these questions, people who have a congenital dwarfism. And they want a short kid because they want their kid to look like them and be part of that community. This has also come up in the bioethics literature. And so, you know, once you open these doors, you pass through a lot of different doors. And the question about what counts as a malady and, you know, and at what point is that malady become normalized and qualify you to be part of a community or not part of a community? There are so many examples of this. There was, for example, a community in Central Africa, I can't remember where, that was salt deprived in their environment, their diet, and they all had big goiters. This became a kind of an issue in the bioethics literature about 15, or more than that, 15, 20 years ago, because some surgeons went
to help to remove these big sort of, you know, benign tumors they had, and give them salt tablets, which actually changed the culture. Because when they had these things, they were kind of, what one of the side effects was that they were kind of quiet and dull and passive. And when they started getting a lot of salt in their diet, they got very active. And that that changed the politics of the region. You know, what counts as a malady? How do you build a life around it? Who's in, who's out? All these questions are up for grabs. Anything else? Any other reactions? I do, if we have time, I want to show you a little bit more of some in another class session. Yeah.
Now, this may be kind of a base question with all these big ethics questions, but what is the majority of the research funding here? Is this mostly government spending, or is it, has private enterprise ventured into a lot of these medical devices yet?
Yeah, good question. Most of it, it depends what it is. Right? So on these prostheses, definitely started with DARPA funding. We're going to talk more about DARPA later. But now there's some commercial value to these things. So I don't know the proportion, I have to tell you. I'm not sure you can even figure it out. But DARPA is very interested, and DOD in general is very interested in using robotics to not only to compensate for injury, right, but also to aid soldiers in the field. There was, just for example, a stated DOD policy, I think it was around 2005, that by, I think it was 2015, a certain proportion of vehicles were going to be autonomous. And they actually withdrew from that when they realized it was harder than it seemed. I think they pulled that back in 2009. Secretary Gates changed the funding. But there are autonomous, you can just go on Google if you haven't seen them, there are these autonomous carriers, basically, right? And the big problem is figuring out how to get them to walk so they don't fall over, because walking turns out to be a little more complicated than people realized at first. There aren't that many ways of getting around. It's either a wheel, and wheels have their obvious limitations, as we find out when we send these things to places like Mars. So there's a good reason to have legs. So that's the kind of thing that they've been working on a little bit more, you know, I think recently. But the answer is definitely DOD funding, but now I think moving to the commercial province. Yeah. Yeah.
Are these medically considered elective surgeries, or can people actually get these covered by the insurance companies? And if so, then does that mean there are people that actually, on the flip side, actually pay for this?
Yeah.
And maybe get like super sound. I know that sounds crazy, but
yeah. So I don't know. I don't believe that. You know, it's a good question. Why don't you write a paper about that? Whether the insurers are paying for these things yet? My, you know, in general, the insurers are drag their feet as long as they can.
Probably not.
I'm guessing they wouldn't. It's not standard of care, you know. So if you're, you know, the thing is to get into a device trial and get, you know, Medtronic or one of these device manufacturers to not only let you into the study, but also, you know, write into your informed consent form that you get to keep it after the study's over, and that they have to keep servicing it. So I don't think there's any. I don't think insurers are going to pay for any of this high-end stuff now. But you know, this is why people are so worried about the future of healthcare, because it's. I mean, even if you lower the cost of these things, right, through. By the fact that you have so many of them, and it's still going to be expensive. There's no way it's not going to get more expensive as we get better at this stuff. Somebody said years ago that the way to flatten the rate of the increase in the cost of healthcare is to shut down the NIH. You shut down the research and development pipeline, and that'll bend that curve. But you know, we don't want to do that. And you'd also have to shut down a whole lot of the work that's being done by the Army, also, and by DARPA. So the challenges for the insurers are just, you know,
mean, and for us, ultimately, are mind-boggling. Even economies of scale, the phrase I was trying to reach for before, are not going to change that. So, I mean, we just took our car in for some, a part that wasn't working today, and it cost us $800, you know, get me started, right? So somebody's got to maintain this stuff, you know? You create a new workforce, but you also create a new source of cost. Somebody, yeah?
I was just going off of his question, would that, since, you know, the Obamacare and the changing of healthcare, would these things be considered pre-existing, like with...
pre-existing condition?
The example of the 2-3-year-old boy who's now getting a cochlear implant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with that, I mean, I'm sure that would create another firestorm of... who pays and what's pre-existing and...
Right, and it depends on, again, on what... I think that it's circular with respect to what the standard of care is. Yeah. And the standard of care is a matter of social consensus as much as anything else. It took a long time for insurers to start to pay for heart transplants, you know, even a lot of public pressure even after they were no longer considered experimental. So it'll be a matter of public pressure and demand. And how organized the interest groups are. Questions, comments, anything else? Reactions? So I'm going to show you more of this, but not tonight, because we're getting a little close. So Martha comes back next week. I also, I think it comes back next week, I believe. Also, 2 weeks, is it? So
we have class.
We don't have class next week? Oh, I'm going to miss you. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. All right. So I will want to at some point show you a little bit more of this. I also want to show you a couple of more recent examples. I'm going to kind of break my rule and go on YouTube for a couple of minutes and show you some of the stuff that's being done now with respect to using simple headsets. Some of you have probably seen this to control what computers are doing, and if you can do that, you can control what's going on in the room, and we'll actually see one of the famous patients who has quadriplegia in this video, who's able to do a whole lot of stuff that would have been impossible a few years ago. So,
just for clarification, insurance does pay for cochlear implants.
They do pay for cochlear implants.
My brother-in-law is an ENT, so I just checked with him.
Thank you. Isn't that great? So this is another example of the technology, right? There's a good piece in the Times today about Google's ambitions. Have you seen that? So, you know, at a dinner party, and if the question comes up, are you supposed to go to Google and ask the question? Is that polite or not? A bit of etiquette. So it is polite in class if there's an uncertainty. And it's great, especially if your brother-in-law is an ENT. But what Google wants to do now, and you know, that the glasses are coming. But you know about that. The Google Glasses. Yeah. So go on the Times website and read about the Google Glasses. The whole idea of interacting. And this is all of a piece, right? This is all part of the same question of, you know, mind augmentation, brain extension. And so where does the medical side of it end and the simple relating to the world and changing your brain with it begin? Google changes your brain, like everything else. Maybe tonight too. Okay, see you. Say goodbye.
Wait. Wanna pop this out and take it with you? So you know. So now I understand your response to my email. I sent you a link today. It wasn't, I just sent, resent it back. It was actually an article in Salon about the legal, about where bioethics is going from a legal standpoint. So, and I thought, you like it.